I'd like to give a name to this talk this afternoon. What is? The Buddha made a curious statement talking about what is. He says, what really is not what it seems like. It's not what things seem like. And yet, it's also not different. Things are not what they seem to be, and yet they're also not different from what they seem to be. And in describing life, Buddha said that he found that there are three things that keep happening. And it was these three characteristics were put into current language by one of my teachers. And the first one is called dukkha, and it's translated into our language as shit happens. Dukkha is usually translated as suffering, but it really means unsatisfactoriness. So shit happens and unsatisfactoriness keeps on happening. The second thing that the Buddha said keeps happening in our lives, our human lives, is that things keep on changing. So one of the teachers that did this modern translation of the three characteristics, one time I went for an interview with her, and I was doing a long retreat, and I was having a hard time, and I was describing my hard time, and she was listening, and she was probably bored, and she said, oh, this will change. And I said, really? How do you know? Because things keep on changing. She wasn't being psychic, she was probably just the third interview in a row where someone was telling how hard it was to be on retreat. This will change. And then the third thing that keeps on happening, they actually made it into like an advice. The third thing to keep on doing is don't take it personally. So this curious idea in Buddhism that there's not a separate self. We could say, don't take it personally. We could even say that because unsatisfactoriness keeps on happening and things keep on changing, why take it personally? It's not in our hands to make something be satisfactory and to make it stay the same. So this phrase, don't take it personally, is maybe the one that we need to go into more, because we do start to notice that things keep on changing. We do start to notice that things aren't giving satisfaction. And we do keep on taking it personally. So there's one opportunity on silent retreat to really see how much we interpret our experience, to take everything as if it's all about me. Everyone else's expression on their face is about me. It's telling me that they're better than I am, or they're worse than I am, or they hate me, or they love me, or whatever. That I did a good job or a bad job. That I'm about to get enlightened, and they're going to be my disciple. Or we're going to get married and have 6 kids. And so there's that whole huge layer of that huge kind of static, like when you turn on the television or the radio and it just goes, that huge amount of our experience that we're taking things personally that really don't have anything to do with us. The person was actually looking just past you, hating or loving that other person or whatever. And sometimes this can be so hellish that we don't realize what an insight it is and how liberating it could be. And so this is one of the ways I'd like to look at this statement of the Buddha. Things are not what they seem, and yet they're not different. So there's the way that things, there's all this suffering going on, and then there's freedom from suffering. And how do we kind of stay with both of those experiences? We experience unsatisfactoriness, and we've heard that there's freedom from that, and in a way we could say we have lots of glimpses every day of freedom from unsatisfactoriness. How to be with both of those things. Things are not what they seem, and yet they're not different. So then there's the importance of seeing that suffering, like, oh God, I'm taking all of this so personally, and it really sucks, it's really heavy. It's not leaving me any space for a meditation or whatever. And how could we see that the friction of that, the heat of that experience, that we keep taking things so personally, that heat, that friction, how could we take that, how could we see that that's actually insight starting to come forth? How could we see that we're starting to notice, it's easier to notice on this retreat than outside, how can we start to notice that I'm actually realizing that I'm taking all of this stuff personally that has nothing to do with me? And even if it did, it would be unbearable to live with, constantly trying to figure out what all of those different facial expressions mean, and so on. So there's a kind of practice that we could use, a statement from one of my teachers from the Japanese healing art of Jinshin Jitsu that I mentioned on the last retreat, and if you've been on retreats with me before, I mention it usually every time. So Mary Burmeister said, "What you think about me is none of my business." And this can be a great way of noticing and kind of letting that burden fall off when I start to think, whatever you think about me is my business, so there, I don't have room for any other business of my own. Then we can start to see this kind of next layer, when maybe someone does have a hard time with you or does want to marry you or whatever, and you do or you don't want to marry them. It is about you. And still this, what you think about me is none of my business. Would that work in a relationship? If you did get married, how would it be? What you think of me is none of my business. Thinking of where I grew up in the United States was the kind of headquarters, it was the big city in the South where the civil rights groups, the people who were fighting for equal rights for people of color, they had their big offices and planned their big actions. And I was just remembering the feeling of going on a pilgrimage to the church where Martin Luther King Jr. used to preach. And getting a feeling of all of that energy and work that all of those people did for us. Because it's not like it was about the liberation of black people, it was about the liberation of the human heart. To get over the idea that we carry inside, that difference needs to mean violence. And thinking about people who practice civil disobedience and nonviolence in the political sphere can give us something to take home into our hearts. That even if someone is at war with you, even if someone doesn't like you because you're different, or does like you because you're different, even if there is something that wants to be personal, and even if it is violence or attack or aggression, the heart of the power of civil disobedience, the heart of the power of nonviolent, we could say demonstration. I like that the word in Spanish is manifestation, manifestación, to manifest non-aggression, non-violence. To resonate non-violence, even if violence is aimed at me, even if someone else is taking me personally. finding the ways that it's still not personal. Finding the ways not to take it personally. Not to believe, even then, that what you think about me is my business, while still seeing clearly this is aggression, or this is seduction, or this is ignoring. So the three kind of main forces that we relate with. So how we could use our actual experience that includes moments of feeling at war with our own experience, and to walk towards freedom from suffering no matter what. Starting with what seems to be, what is, we could say, what's in my experience now, there's heat, there's aggression, there's trying to get what I want by manipulation. So I used the word seduction just a minute ago. And there is ignoring, and it does make things unsatisfactory. It makes life seem to have the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. It makes it seem that shit happens all the time. So how can we walk from our actual experience of what is, that includes a whole range of suffering and glimpses of freedom from suffering? How can we keep on walking to the truth that the Buddha talked about, freedom from suffering, to find out what really is? Is there any question so far or comment? How's the English? Cualquier pregunta.
No.
Vale. How's the English? It's okay. ¿Cómo va? Okay. There's a poem that I love from Hildegard of Bingen, who was a German Christian saint. And she says, the title of the poem is How God Comes to the Soul. And then the poem is about the same length as the title. But it's God speaking. I come to my love as dew to a flower. So dew is the water that seems to come out of nowhere, that comes out of the air in the cool of the morning and starts to form drops on the flower. It seems to come out of nowhere and make the flower shine and sparkle. And I'd like to bring up a few points from a Sufi teaching that was given to one of the people who walked before us. So a Western person who was receiving teachings in Kanpur, a generation before any of us in the room, our elders in the room even were starting their path. But I'd like for it to be really not so much like me telling you what the teaching is, but more like opening out these areas for questioning, so that it could be not like trying to directly walk towards an answer, but trying to feel like what could crystallize or condense like dew coming out of as if nowhere onto the flower that opens in the morning. And I want to add to that poem a kind of an image from our planet, from the driest desert on the planet, supposedly, according to BBC. The top third of the country of Chile is desert, and it actually doesn't, it's not that it rains very, very little, it never rains there. And so this could be that, like, what is when it just seems to be only shit happening? There seems to be no hope for life, there's no rain at all, ever, not even once. And yet there is life there, and there are even big animals that come and they eat the flowers of the cactus. They reach up and with their lips they take the cactus flower off the top, and it's full of water and nutrition. But then how do the cactuses find the water that isn't raining down? What happens is that the desert, like all of Chile, is right along the sea, and there's the right combination of currents that every day there's like a wash of fog that comes over the western part of the desert. And the cactus has these perfect places, these spines for the dew to condense, to land, to form, to turn from air into water. And the really cool things, like a very curious thing that is in nature that I think is a beautiful symbol for things in us, that even in this driest desert in the world, growing on these cacti, on these different cactus plants, there's this kind of mossy lichen that it looks like, I don't know if you have Spanish moss. It must have come from Spain. If you have that in Europe, we have it in the States. It looks like a beard, kind of. It's like very much like yarn or threads. And it's very absorbent. So the dew comes and lands on the cactus, and then this like kind of very loose fabric that's hanging on the cactus just drinks it up and is full of this clean water. And so then all of these animals come and drink from this kind of loose sponge on the cactus, the fox and all these tiny and large animals. And so the idea that I have is kind of like standing even in the desert, even in what seems to be a place that it's impossible to live. Maybe there's a chance that life can find a way there, and that there can be a way that God comes to the soul, in the words of Hildegard of Bingen. There can be a way that the solution to the suffering in life comes over us and drenches us, like plumps up all the fibers of our being, and then is available for life, not just about the cactus. So there's a woman named Irina Tweedy, who had a Sufi teacher in Kanpur, which is not far from Lucknow, where Ajay lives and where I feel more at home than anywhere else on the planet. And she was pretty much the only Westerner there, and sometimes one of the only students there at all. It was not a guru scene. At least she had that advantage. She didn't have to put up with a guru scene too often. But in her meditation, she started experiencing very, very challenging pains and images that to her were like, this is impossible. So images of sexuality and pains in her body, and then starting to feel the energies moving in her. And this was like a British woman long enough ago that would have been more than embarrassing, and certainly more than embarrassing to talk to an Indian teacher about. But having actually had given up everything, having had given her money to her teacher and living in a small rented place, she didn't really have anyone else to talk to about it, so she did talk to him. And it was just a very curious statement that he made. He said that there are three kind of ways, we could say like three styles. And here's where I want it to be, like we really remember, maybe there's like 16 styles or 108 or one for each one of us. Or maybe there's three. Who knows? Let's not like just believe what he said. Or what she understood him to say and then wrote down in her book. So the three kind of ways, it would be as if we had to go through one tunnel or the other. So choose sexuality or choose intoxication, like alcohol or drugs or whatever, or choose gambling. You got to go through one of those tunnels to go on your path. So for her, with the experience of sexual energy in her meditation, being kept up at night with pains and, for her, what were horrible sort of demonic images, And it's not, maybe she wouldn't have written in the book if she had any actual physical sexual life going on, but it seems for sure she didn't. So just containing the energy and letting it burn her up. And it could be kind of like, why? Why do we have to go through one of these three tunnels? And I think that that kind of mindset where we would question why should it be hard and why should it go through these things that we consider dangerous or edgy or whatever. Sex, drugs, and so not rock and roll, but gambling. And I'd like to just say here, again, like maybe there's several other tunnels or one for each of us, but it does seem that it's at some point inevitable, necessary, and wonderful. When we start to turn that mindset that would say, why should it be so kind of yucky or hard or dark? That could say, wow, I've been waiting for a challenge that would kind of sweep away everything that I've built up that could be pretense or built on something too superficial. Like when we get a little bit off track with spiritual practice, it's very easy that very quickly that little bit off track goes way off track within days, weeks, months, sometimes even hours. So something that in us that could be kind of in the childlike way, the child that wants to learn how to stand up, and then it wants to learn how to walk, and then it will run, even if it's falling down, it's going to run. Don't tell it not to. And look at its face when it cries and when it does. Something in us that would, if we could keep making that kind of leap, like the children are making as they're growing, if we could take that kind of willingness to keep leaping, growing, opening, transforming, if we could take that into the inner space, then there is that within us that takes the challenge as like an honor. Like a privilege. Like, thank you, life, for seeing that I am like ready for the next challenge. Instead of, oh God, why do you hate me so much? And so if we find that, okay, something in us that opens like a flower towards challenge and doesn't feel guilty about it. I think often when we have a spiritual pull and there is maybe some kind of affinity for one of those three tunnels, whatever, doorways, and we already feel like a little bit outsiders and we feel this is something wrong and dark and so on, and then so easily that affinity with, let's say, the tunnel of intoxication becomes drug addiction that ends up as suicide, whether purposely or unpurposely. Instead of like meeting that with full affinity, full alignment with a spiritual pull that it can include something that we thought was dark and that society thinks is dark. So for Irina Tweedy, she had like what seemed to her endless nights unable to sleep with this happening to her and only this one statement of her guru to go on. Not like she could go and for an interview every day and say, are you sure this is okay? I'm going to survive this. So with sexuality, maybe slightly different from gambling and intoxication. There's the added factor that it's a kind of biological energy that some bodies could be said to need, like they need food. So it's not, I don't think we could say we need to gamble or we need drugs to survive. Some people might need drugs to survive for other reasons. If there's a mental chemical imbalance, it might be. But let's say, generally speaking, sexuality could be considered to have that extra kind of factor that could be confusing. What is just natural need? What is a kind of wanting that will enter into sexuality in a way that will be unsatisfactory no matter what, no matter what a great person I'm with or how many great people I'm with or if I'm just with myself or whatever? The way of being with the energy of sexuality that can leave room for, let's say, a normal bodily life and still contact the depth of the energy as a kind of power that could really be what like pushes us through the tunnel, like what gives birth to us. That helps us cross the threshold where before we were ashamed. And slowly we start to be with the sexual energy, we let the energy find its place in our daily life. And we also let the energy find its place in our spiritual life, in our meditation. And I do think it has something to do with crossing a kind of threshold, so kind of like crossing from where I'm still ashamed of my spirituality, let's say. I'm still ashamed of my selflessness, my not being a solid I. Somewhere I'm still ashamed that I wouldn't want anyone to see me that naked. I wouldn't want to be witnessed in that intimacy with life. And then slowly there starts to build a trust by going deeply in meditation again and again, coming to that threshold where we do hold back. So as in a conversation, we might say, start to talk about what's most important to us. And I've noticed this so often. People really, literally, their hand covers their mouth and they are dedicated to spirituality for years, for decades. And when they talk about what's really important to them, like not just, oh, this practice and that retreat and the kind of the cruisy one, but like the real intimacy, what's the edge for them, the hand really often goes up. And it's not that that's wrong or bad, it just in a way brings out how much intimacy is inside us. And when we start to find the ways of our ways of touching that, and we realize the only thing covering this, hiding my, wow, how I'm not really the solid thing I thought I was. Oh my God, I'm not separate from you. It's only that little fig leaf. It could be a good idea to cover our mouth, depending on who we're talking to. But in my experience in meditation, then sometimes it's possible that something joyfully just says, even if I would be seen, even if this is not quite safe, even if someone's watching me make love to life, and kind of not as a pushing over and trying to jump off the cliff, but like a very, like the flower opening and the dew appearing. So with, let's say, gambling, I don't have much personal experience, I have to admit, having had no interest ever in gambling. My one contact with gambling was one time. there probably still is. You can get a free bus, or anyway, very cheap bus from New York City to Atlantic City. courtesy of the casinos of Atlantic City in the United States. But To get your refund, you have to walk, in my case with my big dirty India backpack, into the casino, across the seemingly mile-long casino floor, to the counter where they also happen to be selling chips that you could gamble with. And then, if you really, really want, they will give you your money back. But it seems like, I can certainly see in spiritual life the importance of gambling. And so what would be a way of being with, let's say, gambling energy in a way that's not going to be always unsatisfactory? What would be a way of being with gambling energy that already from the beginning is fulfilling? So then it doesn't matter, in fact, if you win or lose. It seems to me that already when we feel 100%, we feel that totality of giving ourselves to life. This might be where it doesn't even matter if your teacher is the rock or the best guru on the planet, because you've already given yourself, the receptivity is there. There's another story that could bring out some of the beauty of gambling also, the importance of gambling. It's a story of an Indian king who was also said to be enlightened, King Janak. And because he was said to be enlightened, from time to time people would come to him for spiritual teachings, even though he was very busy being a king as well. He was also the father of the woman who married Ram, who's in the Yogavasisht, who became God. So, very busy life. And still, sometimes people would come and ask for teaching. So one time, there was a seeker living a very simple life in a cave and learning from his teacher. And then realizing he had learned as much as the teacher knew. And the teacher agreed, "You've learned everything I have to give you. Now go to Janak." And so the seeker went to the royal city, to the palace. It might have been a little bit like walking across the casino floor with a dirty India backpack. Straight from the airport, 20 hours on the plane, sleeping on the floor in the airport. Walk past the police arresting someone on the way to the bus station in New York City. Smelly, entering the palace. So King Janak, like some of my Indian teachers, played a little bit around. Or maybe we could say King Janak, like God with the dew, didn't just come straight forward with a cup of water. When the seeker said, "I'm thirsty, give me teachings," Janak said, "Okay, I'm busy, I'll see you later, I'll see you in the morning. You'll be led to your room is on that wing of the palace. You're very welcome, I'll see you tomorrow." And so the seeker was led to his room, past all of these amazing, fancy, sparkling corridors and dancing girls and so on. And he was given a silk bed to sleep on in a huge room. There were platters of food in the room and so on. But he couldn't sleep. The bed was very comfortable, very soft, very silky. And it just so happened that there was a very sharp sword hanging by a very thin thread right over his place on the bed. So a different way of not sleeping, different but maybe similar to Irina Tweedy. Not sleeping and very angry. What is this pretending to be a spiritual guide and living this lifestyle and then giving me a bed with a sword over it? And so he went, like most of us might do, the next morning to say, "Thank you anyway, but I'm going away." you're not really enlightened. You're not really trying to help me. You're not really trying to help anyone, etc. And then Janak had just the chance to say, there was enough seeking still there that hadn't gotten killed by the silk and the sword. It's because I know that there's a sword hanging over me by a thread. I know that death can and will come in a second. That I can live a free life in this world. So just that not holding back, remembering what is. What is the one thing that we do know? Now that we've been born, the one thing that we have in common. We have it more in common than shit happens, things keep changing, and don't take it personally. We have this life that will end. And we can feel during this life that will end something precious in it. That if we don't give it, is wasted. If we don't give it every day, it's not living. If we don't die many times a day, we are not alive. So just some of the exploration of how we could be with the energy of sexuality, the energy of gambling, in a way that from the beginning is already fulfillment. And then just similarly with intoxication, drugs, alcohol, whatever. How to be with something addictive in a way that is fulfilling and fulfillment? Or what is it in the attraction towards that intoxication? What is it in that pull? How could we be with that pull? How could we find like the pure stream of intoxication that doesn't give a hangover? So one of the things, and there may be many that are there, is just that we could say unself-consciousness, in the sense of sometimes on retreat we're watching ourselves so much that it would be like living in a police state. The way of watching ourselves is actually controlling rather than allowing, receiving, experiencing, and knowing. And so when we're living that way, when we're living in a controlling way, trying to control and pretend, instead of trying to find out what we are, what actually is, and then from there, how to walk to what really is. So actually, in like Spanish, maybe in French, actuellement, means now, what is. And then what really is. And also really, realmente, I don't know if it's in French also, but in Spanish, royally, like a king or queen, what is. Like a king of life, like a queen of life, what really is. So the kind of pull, the attraction towards letting go of the pretense. The attraction towards letting down the guard, letting down the hiding. Letting down even the hiding in our current state of consciousness, the way we know ourselves. So that we could feel that pull towards expanded states of consciousness. where there's no interest in pretending and controlling and hiding. So walking from what is, our experience now is often that we would meditate on an object, whether the object is the feeling in the body of the body breathing, or whether the object is the feet, or whether the object is a sensation of loving kindness in the heart, or the whole body, or the whole world. Or whether the object is something more subtle, like a joy that rises up and fills us. Or whether the object is just the stillness. Different kinds of objects. Somehow, it's that threshold that I talked about with the sexuality also. If we could be shamelessly, not controlling, not pretending, and allowing something in us to give everything, to gamble, we can kind of pass through, like as if a kind of membrane, like a skin, we could pass through from one side to the other. The skin being the sense of I. So sometimes we're me aware of the stillness, me aware of the joy bubbling up, me aware of the anger, the war going on in my brain, the pain in my back or knee or whatever. And then sometimes there's a sense of, I am aware of nothing. There's not any other object than nothingness, but I am aware of that. And that's when we're like starting to pass through the membrane. The dew is starting to form out of nowhere. And then if we can slowly, like with this feeling kind of being washed by love to the other side, not trying to get it. In Buddhism, they talk about when there's no longer someone saying there is nothing. There's not even an I anymore. That much intimacy. They talk about it, the name of that next step is a weird name. It's hard to believe that we could ever know what the hell they're talking about. It's called neither perception nor non-perception. But I do think that every day we have some kind of experience like that. We're just probably not really aware of it. Where the world is still going on, it's not that everything goes black or white. There's still like leaves falling like specks of gold from the tree, and we can hear the sound is there. We could hear that the sound is there. The life is going on unimpeded, in and out. And so there's not a perceiver. And in a way that frees also the world that seems to be happening, what seems to be happening, what's actually happening, what's happening currently in our current experience. It's also freed to be vastness in a dewdrop. So the world is not what it seems to be, and also it's not different from what it seems to be. Neither perception nor non-perception. I don't know if I was sleeping or awake. But something fresh is going on. I don't know if I was asleep or awake, but there seems to be an earthquake happening today. So sometimes it feels like very gentle. And we could say sometimes there's been so much dew accumulating on our spines and on our lichens that life just comes and takes a bite. And we could just let all of our constructions be swept away. So expanding somehow one step more. Giving ourselves away again. Letting life be intoxicated in that no holding back, no covering up. That still somehow is nourishing. It might be the only clue we have that we're not sort of really losing it. But somewhere something feels nourishing. And it's exactly there when we do fall apart that much. That is the transformative space where the habit energies do get burned away or dissolved in the dew. Is there any question or comment? Anything at all to say?
Sometimes it feels like I can, like I hear so well the difficult parts of what, and then the other parts are just almost a memory. You know, even in meditation, it's like, I mean, I'm here, they're there, but at times they're a memory and it becomes so vulnerable when they're just a memory. And,
do you mean your trust in that?
Mm-hmm. And a connection and inspiration.
Mm.
And I'm not sure what to do.
Yeah. The other morning, I was just looking out across that valley and lake. And there, just a bird flew across the lake. And it may have been the morning after the leopard was near our house the night before. And it just kind of, it was like a such a nice feeling to feel the bird flying across, and I just felt like what's maybe mostly in our hands to do a lot of the time is kind of walking on the ground, like even the most beautiful, powerful leopard and the gangs of monkeys, they can't fly across the lake. They can jump from one tree to another. They can eat all the seeds in the tree. They can really go across the landscape step by step. But if we could know that somewhere in us, there's also this other way that is happening and will happen. If we can know that it's not like all of those knots that sometimes we're aware of when we really feel like shit really happens. It's not that we have to go and untie them, like all those seed pods, and eat every single seed. That's part of what's going on. It's part of the ecosystem. But there are also the birds. And it is hard to find inspiration, to trust these things that we can certainly not describe, and hardly feel, and usually not remember, especially when we really need to remember them. But it can be a kind of practice of noticing, just like the teacher that said, this will change to me when I thought I was in hell forever. Sometimes we can encourage ourselves that way. This experience of what is will change because it's not really all that is. It's one perspective, this relative truth that things change and that it's unsatisfactory. And then if we can find, like, the gambler and the shameless, what is the word? Slut. And the drunkard, who, even if I had to go through every single seed pod for a million lifetimes, that we could reach in and feel like this is nourishing something that nothing else nourishes. Just a sec, I'm going to make sure if there's anything else because it's a very important question. So, an image that came to me years ago that I like a lot when I was speaking about sort of passing through the membrane or the skin is like the experience of trees when they're drawing the water up through their bodies and then the water passes through the leaf invisibly into the air. And without that, we would all be dead. But that kind of, it's the leaf and then it's still water, but we can't see it. And if we could kind of not so actively, but a little bit actively, we open ourselves towards that like that wants to fly. Not because it wants to fly away from the heavy and the unsatisfactory and the disorienting change, but it just wants to fly. Without even really knowing what flying is. I think if we find a way to leave space for that, then I think we are receptive to that support and encouragement that we also need to give each other. Certainly I know for myself, without the encouragement of my friends and teachers, I don't know what would be happening, but I am certain that I would not be here. I don't think I would have survived. And so there can be that not shyness of sometimes just asking for encouragement, even saying like, tell me I'm okay. Or you know, like, you don't even have to tell me anything fancy, just tell me this is what is happening.
I mean, what you were saying to me was just so profound, so deep. I'm not even sure if I can even talk after that. But like a lot of it, isn't it? Like you were saying, I mean, opening up to everything. moment, is probably quite different than anybody else. And yet, there are moments when I'm there and I'm with it, and then there's moments there that I can't even think of it.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the change. And when I'm with it, I think, oh, this is it. I'm going, I'm moving. And then I get up the next morning and everything is exactly the opposite. And that was somehow an illusion. And then thinking that's permanent. Mm-hmm. But then I don't know, just going with it and just giving up again and again and again and moving on.
So there's the, when we can, like the subtle shift of when you're saying giving up, I think what you mean is like, if I connect first to what I trust, to what is already fulfilling, to a kind of mode that is already fulfilling, then I'm moved. Then I'm with it. You're kind of making these gestures, and I get the feeling like we're in there and it's easy. We're going with our flow and it's easy. And then the next morning, whoa, it seems to be the opposite and it seems hard. And so part of it is that remembering, is there any way I can find what feels like enough anyway? What feels like fulfilling already? First, and then being moved, instead of trying to figure out what I'm gonna do that's gonna make me feel fulfilled. Okay, and when that's easy, great. And when it's hard, if we can take, this is hard, in that way that I was saying, a challenge as a kind of gift, instead of as a punishment or a sign that there's something wrong with me or this shouldn't be happening. But if we can find a way that this is hard and it could bring a smile to our face. Like when Gyan is going up those huge stone steps to our house, he loves it. It's really hard for him. I mean, it would be hard for us to go up a step that was half as tall as we are with one foot, and he loves it. So that kind of, if we can take what is hard, not pretend it's not hard, but not assume that it's something wrong, that it means something's wrong with me, etc. But let that call out the bird or whatever. Let that call the dew.
I mean, to me, it's almost a reversal of normal thinking.
Yes, it's a reversal of ego strategy.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So it's 5 o'clock, almost. We just have a minute together silent. Till 5 o'clock.